Welcome to The Point. I'm Catherine Iden, filling in for Mindy Todd, and it's our monthly book show. Today, we're going to talk about detective stories. You know, the ones that suck you in and make it hard to put them down because you need to know who did it and how. With me this morning is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at the Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
And Nelson Richel, author and a humanities professor at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so detective stories. This is a fun one. And I think I like to ask at the beginning to kind of, I want to hear how you think of this genre or subgenre, depending on how you look at it. So Jill, talk to us a little bit about it.
Well, let me just say that we're specifically focusing this morning on the detectives themselves.
Yep.
As opposed to plot or, and it's really the characters. And I do think, I found this great little bit about why it is people love series, because mm-hmm. I personally am happy to read one mystery. It's one of the reasons I love Manette Walters, for example, her early mysteries. She doesn't have a recurring character. You read one and then that's it. You're done. Whereas if you get involved with a character, if you decide you love some particular detective, you've got your work cut out for you, generally speaking. And one of the things in this book called Make Mine a Mystery, which is a reader's guide to mystery and detective fiction, they talk about what this appeal is about a series. And basically, it's about the character. It's about whoever that detective is. And one of the things they say is, in discussing why readers like mysteries, the appeal of the main character cannot be overemphasized. Readers form an emotional attachment to their favorite characters and enjoy reading books and series about the same character. And I cannot, as a librarian, I can only confirm this is completely true, and that people have really strong feelings, and I will be talking about some of my really strong feelings about characters in mysteries, detectives, and what happens to them and their loved ones can be really upsetting. So I think it'll be a really fun show.
I know. And I think it's so interesting that there is such an appeal to characters that carry you throughout different adventures or different mysteries that they have to solve, versus other genres that maybe don't have that same type of setup and pull that they do for. Because you think of a detective story or mystery and you can think of serials and you can think of distinct characters right off the top of your head. So, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, the format itself, it has an American root with Edgar Allan Poe, The Murders in the Rue Morgue.
Mm-hmm.
And he introduces us to his detective, Augustine Dupin. And from that, it takes off. But the format really flourished in England after the Poe business. And a lot of it has to do, it's very much tied to the advent of journalism through the 19th century. Becomes a fascination with reading about induced papers covering crimes.
Mm.
And the more sensational the crime is, the more people will become interested. And of course, that all tied to the greater literacy and so on. And by mid-century, there starts to be, of course, with Poe in 1841, but by mid-century, the genre starts to emerge. And there's a wonderful book by Lucy Ward, The Art of English Murder, which really has, it's a great book, and it follows into, it sort of tracks the fascination with crime through the English 19th century and how that develops into the detective story. Like she has in the top, from Jack the Ripper and Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie and Alfred Hitchcock. So it gives, you know, so she ties a lot in there with horror too. But one of the things that's really fascinating that she picks on is Madame Tussaud's waxworks. Yes, and they're set up in Baker Street, of course, where Holmes will have his office.
Oh, yes.
A few decades later.
And just knowing that, I mean, I love that we all know where he lives. You know, this
oh,
is
yes.
like,
right.
And people visit that spot, right?
He's, because,
like
famous.
He really exists.
Yes,
right.
And to try to tell some people that he doesn't exist. And so Tussaud's in her waxwork, she starts she started off with copies of heads from the French Revolution. But she gets into, particularly the business, after she passes away, starts to make wax figures of known criminals. And so they start, and they always make the case, you know, how accurate they are, but you know, who knows how they are. But it's a very fascinating area, and it ends up being called Chamber of Horrors. But those are the criminals, and some of them are murderers, and some of them are not. Some of them are well-known thieves. And this book also starts to get into certain crimes that stood out. And there's one, a murder of Maria Martin by a fellow named William Corden, just a rural English murder that caught the popular imagination. She was murdered in a barn, and then all these things. And there's melodramas that come out of it, and all this fascination with that. And then you eventually get this whole... Even in the Victoria and Albert Museum, they have puppeteers from this murder case. It was a very popular form. But out of that comes the detective and, of course, Sherlock Holmes and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that also reminds me, when I worked at the Boston Athenaeum, I had a researcher there one time who was going through all these 19th century newspapers because he was following this murder trial. And the murder trials were front page. I mean, they covered the whole page. And she happened to be, the case, as I recall, had to do with a sleepwalking woman who murdered somebody in her sleep, apparently. But it went on for pages and pages. I mean, issues and issues. I mean, that whole interest just in general in true crime sort of engages with the detective.
Yeah, and the more gruesome the trial testimony, the more
interest. Exactly. Well, and it was like reading a detective novel to read those 19th century articles.
Right. It's fun to go along for the trip where you're safe at home, but you can kind of delve into these kind of creepy worlds with somebody you trust, with that character, as you started out by saying, someone you trust to take you along and help you kind of together, in a sense, figure out what happened and how, right?
That's right. And the only person I know that reads the end first is my sister. And I'm like, why do you do that? Well, I want to know.
I know.
Oh, dear.
I can't imagine that either, but I know that that's a popular thing and that I was talking among some of my coworkers about this upcoming show, and someone said, you know, there's books out there supposedly where they seal the back, they seal the ending so that you can kind of make it through and read it as intended. But
of course, when we start to read a series of stories of the same detective, we know that detective is going to solve the case. Mm-hmm. So then it becomes, well, how is it done? And that becomes a very interesting process in its own right. And you know, the different detectives have different tactics. Sherlock Holmes arrives in the scene with very much a forensic approach. He's got the magnifying glass. He's studying the footprints in the dust and the study in Scarlet. And of course, there's also that element that the literary detective is often outside of society, outside of mainstream. When Watson is first introduced to Holmes, he's beating a corpse with a stick.
Yeah.
And of course, it makes sense what he's trying to do. He's trying to ascertain about bruising. If we see, is bruising done before, death or whatever? And so he's doing it. But for Watson to see this in this laboratory, in this fellow beating a corpse with a
stick.
Well,
and is Watson the first sidekick? I mean, sidekicks are hugely popular in detective fiction. Is Watson the first
no,
one?
No, he wasn't. Dupin with Poe has one. And there's a few others before that.
And that maybe helps us make the detective who is kind of like the savant in a lot of ways, right? That's somewhat outside society, a little inaccessible in a way. I mean, Watson especially is a way for us to understand and see how he perceives Sherlock, for instance. And that has a lot of cachet. And Sherlock has enjoyed a resurgence in recent years on TV. So, there's something about those stories that has a timeless quality, even though they're rooted in a certain time period.
Yeah, and if we go on to Holmes for a little bit, he'll recount where Watson's been something, and so in the story Scandal in Bohemia, the setup is Watson has moved out of the Baker Street and hasn't seen him for a while, and he goes by and the lights are on, he goes up to see him, and so we'll just pick it up here, and he says, Watson to the narrative, with hardly a word spoken, but with a kindly eye, he waved me to an armchair, threw across his case of cigars, because they all smoked at that time, and indicated a spirit case and a gasoline in the other corner. Okay. Wedlock suits you, he remarked. I think, Watson, that you have put on 7.5 pounds. 7.5 pounds since I saw you. 7, I answered. Indeed. I should have thought a little bit more, just a little more, I fancy, Watson. And in the practice again, I observe, you did not tell me you intended to go into harness again. And so, of course, Watson's a medical doctor and had been out of it. Now he's gone back. But how do you know? Watson asks. And Watson never fails to ask. and Holmes says, I see it. I deduce it. How do I know that you have been getting yourself very wet lately, and that you have a most clumsy and careless servant girl? My dear Holmes, this is too much. You would certainly have been burned had you lived a few centuries ago. It is true that I had a country walk on Thursday, came home in a dreadful mess, but as I have changed my clothes, I can imagine how you could deduce that. And as to Mary Jane, she is incorrigible, and my wife has given her notice. And there, again, I fail to see how you work it out. Holmes continues, it is simplicity itself. He says, my eyes tell me that inside your left shoe, just where the firelight strikes it, the leather is scorched by 6 almost parallel cuts. I mean, it just goes on. Yeah. All these little observances. And and Watson, of course, always
confounded.
Yeah, confounded. And how do you do it? And that kind of thing. But yeah, but it becomes a formula. That then it's a welcome formula when we see it.
Mm-hmm. And you have a book in your hand that you've moved. So do you want to move on to that, or do you have a comment?
Well, I just want to say that I think one of the reasons Sherlock Holmes is still one of my favorites is that because in sixth grade, my sixth grade teacher, who used to read to us after every lunch period to calm us all down, read us The Speckled Band, which is, I still think, one of the most phenomenal Holmes stories is that Speckled Band. And if you have never read The Speckled Band story, by all means do so. It is so creepy and why she was reading that to sixth graders, I don't know, but it made me a lifelong fan.
It's a great introduction to Holmes. That was the first story I ever read of Holmes.
Mm. Is that right?
It is, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
It pulls you right in.
Well, I have a detective that I have only just discovered this summer. As some of you may or may not know, I actually had shoulder surgery at the end of May, and thus I had a lot of time to read this summer, which I don't normally have, so it was very exciting. And one of the things I discovered was this author named Charles Finch, who I had not heard of other than via Twitter. There was somebody this is the magic of Twitter. Somebody I followed also followed Charles Finch, and it turns out that he has written lots of these books. The first one is called A Beautiful Blue Death, and it is the first of the Charles Lennox mysteries. And one of the discussions that came up before I even began this was, where do you start when you have somebody who's been doing this whole series? And one point of view is you dive right into the middle because they get better, of course, as they go along. Now, my feeling is you have to start from the beginning, although this has not always been the case with me. I mean, I certainly have jumped into certain series in the middle, and then you love that and you go back. But in this case, I was like, well, I've got the time. I'm going to start with volume one. And I love this. The fellow who is our detective is a Victorian gentleman, armchair explorer, likes nothing more than to relax in his private study with a cup of tea, a roaring fire, and a good book. Sound familiar? I mean, it both plays on all the tropes of the Victorian detective, but also in some weird way modernizes things. His detective has a liking for Thackeray, and I happen to be reading Thackeray this summer as well, so I was really delighted with that. And as with any series, the author learns a lot about their character as they go along. So with every book, it seems like the author learns more about their character. And so to begin at the beginning of a series, you get the opportunity of, it's as if you're meeting somebody new, and as you know, learn more and more about them every time you meet them again. And it's exactly like what happened, which is, again, is why I think starting at the beginning is great. But he has a servant who helps him, dissolve. And in this case, there's been a maid that's been murdered in a very fancy house. house, and he also has this wonder, right, living right next door to him is his childhood sweetheart, who he was friends with as a child, and he has clearly feelings for, and I can only imagine as things develop there at some point. And here's a little bit to give you an idea of how he incorporates the reading of Thackeray in with his detective. He ate a breakfast of eggs, toast, dark coffee, and a large orange. He read the final chapters of The Small House at Allington in bed as he ate, going through both the food and the book with great relish. And when he laid the book down, he felt satisfied. After feeling more and more depleted in recent days, he felt that he had taken his small break now and had a great deal of energy again. So the fact that he could be in bed reading Thackeray, I mean, you either love this stuff or you think, yeah. Oh no, I want something more ghoulish, right? But I'm really looking forward to reading more of these. This is indeed the first of the Charles Lennox mysteries, and it's called A Beautiful Blue Death by Charles Finch.
866-999-4626, or you can email us at thepointcapeandislands.org. We're talking about books and characters and part of the detective story genre. Do you have a character that you just love and keep coming back to, or just a one-off book, you know, detective book that you just love? Give us a call or send us an email. We have to take a break. We'll be right back after a moment. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, and today we're discussing detective stories with my guest Jill Erickson, reference librarian at the Falmouth Public Library, and Nelson Richel, an author and humanities professor at Massachusetts Maritime Academy. Do you have a favorite story or character in the genre detective series? What do you love about it? Give us a call, send us an email, 866-999-4626, or you can send us an email with your suggestions, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Nelson, you've got a book right there ready to go. What do you want to share?
Well, this is Father Brown, actually, from J.K. Chesterton, which is the PBS series now, or British series that's on there. And Father Brown is a curious detective, particularly because he starts before the Great War, or before World War One. It's usually that what we see in detective literature after the First World War, we move away from a lot of the forensic evidence that, like, Holmes gets into, and it's sort of because of the gruesomeness, presumably because of the gruesomeness of the war, there's a sort of a shift and a more cerebral type of stories. But Father Brown, I mean, it's hard to really turn him into an action hero, which of Holmes will lend himself to. Those recent films 10 years ago or so,
yeah.
Downey Jr., very much an action hero. But Father Brown in Stories of the Blue Cross, and it's a short story, and there's Father Brown is moving a large blue cross that belongs to the church, and it's a very valuable historic relic. And he knows that there's a famous thief, a fellow named Flambeau from the continent. He believes this fellow will try to steal it, and he's on a train. And he knows there's a famous French detective that's chasing Flambeau. So once Brown makes the contact with, and Flambeau is always in disguises and so on, and so he starts to goes through he's disguised as the priest. So the two priests are walking through this village or this town, so Brown tries to create diversions, and he breaks a window. He tries to do all these things to get the police to start chasing, following the trail. Then he knows that the detective Valentin will pick it up. And finally, at the end, and Flambeau thinks he's led him into this wooded area, or they're sitting on a bench, there's no one around, and he goes through this whole thing of pretending to be a priest. Then finally Flambeau says, "Just hand over that sapphire cross of yours, will you? We're all alone here, and I could pull you to pieces like a straw doll." And Brown just sits there. And Flambeau just gets more irritated. He says, "Yes, I am Flambeau." He finally bursts out. And then there's more pause. And then finally, Father Brown explains that, well, we're not alone. And because there's two policemen that have followed us. And there's another famous detective, Valentin. And, of course, it all comes out, and that is the case. And they've followed it. But it's really interesting how and, of course, Flambeau doesn't understand how he could have done that. And how did you realize that I was that I was who I was, and because he thought he was carrying off the guise as this priest. And they were talking about all the theology and everything, but Brown knew right along. Because one of the things at a restaurant, they went to have a meal, and he overpaid. And he changed the bill, and then Flambeau doesn't pick up that he's overpaying. He doesn't want to cause. He realizes that Flambeau doesn't want to attract attention to himself, whereas Brown's attracting attention to the two of them. Flambeau, it's a curious little detective. But you know, one of the things with the detectives, they tend to be they tend not to be police. And before the Second World War, it's after that we start to see many more police detectives. But before that, there's a tendency of sort of having detectives outside the legal process. They have more flexibility, but it plays on a perception. Certainly, Holmes played on the perception that the police were not as competent as perhaps they should be. Which certainly Scotland Yard in late 19th century was fairly competent for the time period. So it's a little unfair, some of the things that Holmes's treatment of some of them. But
it also allows, I imagine, the author a little bit of literary license. Oh. I mean, you know, Father Brown, so a man of the cloth, and so you've got this trust element built in. And also you can kind of play up the fact that he can get confessional type, you know, information from people because he's part of the church. And then, you know, maybe people like Sherlock Holmes who kind of break the rules or bend the rules, mm-hmm. you know, there's more room there, I would imagine, than if you were a police officer. Of course, there are plenty of detective stories with police officers, but still, I mean, sure, you can see why it might be attractive as a writer to go down that way.
And Brown's his little sort of ace in the hole, if you will, is that he understands human nature after listening to so many confessions.
Yeah.
That indeed makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, he says that a lot. Yeah.
He would be a good detective.
Yeah. And again, another series that lent itself to a successful screen adaptation, to TV show.
Well, and the screen adaptations are very interesting to me. And I have some real issues with those screen adaptations. In fact, the next person I'm talking about is Elizabeth George. And she has this detective, Thomas Linley. And I had never seen any of the screen adaptations. I had read many of the books. And when I saw her Thomas Linley, did not look anything like my Thomas Linley. And I was like, this is not right. I literally couldn't watch them because my picture in my head, and of course, that's the fabulous thing about reading. You get to make your own pictures. They give you, you know, an outline, but then you get to, and so I never, however, it is astonishing to me how many people come to mysteries because of something they've seen on PBS or wherever, that they really fall in love with what Thomas Linley looks like in that particular series. And Elizabeth George, the first book that I read by her was actually the seventh in the series, Playing for Ashes. And so it was so fascinating, though, to me, her characters from the get-go. I was like, I need to go back. I want to know more about these people. And this is sort of the reverse way to read mysteries, is you throw yourself into the middle as if you had just met somebody, and then you go back, and the longer you know them, the more you get to know about them. And so this is very true with Elizabeth George and her books, A Great Deliverance. And the Thomas Linley mysteries, the first one of which is The Great Deliverance, and Playing for Ashes came out in 1994. And she, again, had already written seven. That would have been the seven. She's best known for this series. And she introduces her two main series sleuths, the charming, sophisticated new Scotland Yard detective, Inspector Thomas Linley, who is also, as it happens, the eighth Earl of Asherton, and his rough around the edges working class partner, Detective Sergeant Barbara Havers. And it's really interesting to see how the two of them play off of each other, not just because she is female and he is male, but also because of their class differences. And the incredible thing to me about Elizabeth George is that she ended up in one of her mysteries killing off one of her main characters. In fact, she killed off the wife of Thomas Linley. And because people had such attachment to Linley, it was devastating. And it's, she ended up writing this whole letter to her readers about why she had done it, because she got so much, people were so devastated. And you had no idea this was coming. I mean, you thought, oh, and suddenly Helen is dead. And Helen was one of her best characters. And so she puts out this really long, I will share a little bit of it, bit about how you write detective stories and why she might have killed off one of her main characters. And it turns out, you know, authors might get bored with their characters or might want to do something a little different. And it's really hard. So she writes, to understand that decision, the first thing you need to consider is the two alternatives available to a writer when she decides to create a series that features continuing characters. A series like this can be approached by freezing the characters in time, place, and circumstance, or it can be approached by allowing the characters to grow, change, develop, and move through time. Characters who have been frozen in time, place, and circumstance are best exemplified by Hercule Poirot, Miss Marple, Sherlock Holmes, and then she says in parentheses, with the obvious exception of that trip over the waterfall, and Dr. Watson. More simplistically, perhaps Nancy Drew is frozen in time, place, and circumstance. Eternally, that 17 or 18-year-old girl in the roadster that became a sports car. Language changes. Nancy does not. And she says, when a writer is doing a crime series and the continuing characters are frozen in time, place, and circumstance, the reader's focus is almost exclusively on the puzzle, the crime, and its solution. And what she wants people to be paying attention to are the characters that she has developed, not just the plot and who did it. She wants you to really care about her characters, and you do. Thus, you are devastated when she kills one of them off. So it's a really interesting series. It's really heartbreaking, and it was really hard for me to go back to them once she had killed. I did, but very hard to go back to one. And in fact, the book she wrote after that had none of her regular characters. It was really about how Helen had gotten killed, but it was about the families that were involved with that, not with her main characters.
Oh, wow. So, big departure there, then.
Huge departure. But she seems to still be writing, so I guess everything went up. And she's an American writing about England, which is also sort of fascinating.
Yeah, that's got its own thing going on. 866-999-4626 or the point at capeandislands.org. We are talking about detective stories. Do you have one that you would like to share? We'd love to hear from you. Nelson, what do you have next? I saw you kind of looking through a few books there.
Yes. We can't have this show without talking about Agatha Christie.
Yes, absolutely.
We have to do it.
We had the first mention from Jill, and now we can expand.
And certainly, you know, Christie enters into the genre at an interesting time. And it again ties to the First World War. She's working in a military hospital in Torquay in southern England. And there's a lot of, you know, of course, the wounded soldiers coming in and so forth. But Torquay was also inundated with a great influx of Belgian refugees who had escaped Belgium when the Germans ran it over. And so, one of the things, of course, that she observed was that there was a lot of people in England who resented the Belgians coming in. They were afraid they were going to take jobs. And in fact, for a period of time, the English government did not allow them to work. So the refugees were coming in. What are they going to do? Where are they going? And they flooded in into southern England in particular. And so she, and while she's working at that hospital, she works in the apothecary. And she starts to learn about, well, okay, the wrong prescription amount could be deadly. And she starts to learn about poisons and all of that. So, and it's during that period that she comes up with the idea of Hercule Poirot and writes, and the first story of any of her stories is a Poirot story, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. And Poirot is such an interesting figure, particularly if we think about him, you know, in terms of a migrant crisis and how she takes Poirot presents him that he can solve cases that the English police cannot. And Poirot's background was he was a police detective in Belgium, and he was retired by this time. And that we were chatting earlier. Right. That's one of the things that Christie always apparently at some point regretted, that she had made Poirot in the first story older. Because she kept writing him for so long.
Oh, right. There's so there was so always much the problem of there.
How old is he? And Pearl, sometimes he has Hastings as a sidekick and Captain Hastings, and sometimes without. So this is the first time that we see Pearl. And I think it's an interesting description. Pearl was an extraordinary looking little man. He was hardly more than 5'4", but carried himself with great dignity. His head was exactly the shape of an egg, and always perched in a little on one side. It's always the egg comes back constantly in the story, that it's always a little to the side, however that means. And the neatness of his attire was almost incredible. I believe a speck of dust, and this is through Hastings is telling this story, I believe a speck of dust would have caused him more pain than a bullet wound. Yet this quaint, dandified little man was, I was sorry to see, now limped badly, had been in his time one of the most celebrated members of the Belgian police. As a detective, his flair had been extraordinary, and he had achieved triumphs by unraveling some of the most baffling cases of the day. And when we get into the case, that Pearl in this very first case is very much like we see him throughout until the very last case when, well, I can't give that away. She changes a lot with that. But she had grown resentful of Pearl, too. He was just too popular, and she got tired of him. Conan Doyle got tired of Holmes.
I was
going to
say, yeah, Sherlock
him
as
off
well.
But had to bring him back.
And I heard, I don't know if this is true, but I heard that Sherlock had to come back because Doyle's mother was especially upset that the character had been killed.
Well, and see, Elizabeth George was probably sick of Linley, but decided she couldn't kill him off, so she killed his wife off, you know.
gotta get some emotion somewhere. Sue from West Tisbury is on the line. Sue, thanks for calling in.
Hi, I just wanted to suggest that the Maisie Dobbs series. She's a really good detective. She's a private investigator. It's Jacqueline Winspear is the author of that series. That's all. I just wanted to, I'm always anticipating the next book. It's a new series, maybe the last 10 years.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for the suggestion. Can you tell us a little bit more about Maisie, what time period it's set in? Or it's fun to kind of hear about a woman detective.
Yeah, it's the first book starts with the advent of World War I, and it goes right through that time period into World War II.
And I happen to have a reference book with her. I was actually thinking about talking about her as well. And it says here, after her experiences as a nurse on the battlefronts of World War I, and after the disappearance of the doctor who was her love, she returns to England to open her own investigative agency, which practices psychology as much as it does detection.
Ooh, sounds good. Thanks. Thank you, Sue. I appreciate your call.
All right, bye.
We have Jim on the line from Harwich. Jim, thanks for giving us a call.
Well, hello.
Hello.
And I was going to, I think you're probably way ahead of me, but I was going to bring up the Harry Bosch series by Michael Connelly.
Harry Bosch series. Okay, thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Harry Bosch is a Los Angeles police detective, and we follow his career from early in his career until well after his retirement, where he's volunteering for a smaller police department and doing his first undercover work ever. They're all police procedurals. He is very methodical and careful in how he investigates crimes, and he uses his instincts as much as his scientific bent. He's very careful about how he does them. And it goes from the black ice until well after his retirement in Two Kinds of Truth.
And Jim, I'm just wondering, did you start reading those from the beginning? Or did
yes.
you plunge into the middle? No, you started at the beginning.
The first, I'm sure that the first book I read was not the black ice, although I think it's best to always to read a series from the beginning.
Yeah.
That was probably not the first one I read, But I have gone through them in order, too.
Ah, so you've revisited these books. These are good books.
Yes, I've dipped into them at various times. But now he's well into his retirement, and I wonder about the future of his daughter, who's now in college, who has learned to be a crack shot under his tutelage, and is likely to end up either as a profiler or some sort of detective herself.
I love it. So the author clearly has a plan to continue this series. That's great. Jim, thank you so much for that suggestion. We appreciate it. 866-999-4626. Or you can email us at point@capeandislands.org. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, and today we're discussing detective stories with Nelson Richel, author and humanities professor at Mass Maritime Academy, and Jill Erickson, reference librarian at the Falmouth Public Library. And I have a couple emails here I want to quickly talk about. MB agrees with you, Jill, loves the Thomas Lindley of Scotland Yard Elizabeth George series, saying that the series indeed fulfills the pattern that you mentioned of learning to know more about the detective as the series continues. Many of the books are focused on him personally, although the most recent is not, just finished it. And then we've got two emails here. I'm going to kind of combine them. One from Kate and then the other from Nan and Brewster. They both mention the Ruth Galloway series. Are you familiar with that? Not familiar with that. Well, Kate says she's been enthralled by the series written by Ellie Griffiths, a forensic archaeologist at the fictional University of North Norfolk, who works with the police in King's Lynn. She says it's a real series and kind of needs to be started at the beginning. So we have another person here who believes in starting
at the beginning. That's great.
And Nelson, let's see what you've got here in your vast pile.
Okay. Yeah, because usually when I'm on, I talk about older material. But what am I? Yeah, I don't know. So I'm
that's okay. There's a place. That's good.
Yeah, but I'm locked into this thing in the past. However.
But it all connects to the future.
Well, it does. But one of my, maybe my favorite literary detective is a very contemporary series. And it's Anne Cleves' series of the detective Vera Stanpole, which of course also is on television. And I have to admit, I first saw it on television and then went to the novels. And the novels I thought it was extraordinary because the series is very close to the novels. And the characters very close, but there's nothing lost in it. And it's like they complement each other, which was really, I thought, phenomenal.
Wow, that's difficult to do.
And it was exactly as, because I'd seen her first. So,
I mean, so of course she was exactly
as you pictured her.
Yeah, so that was going in that direction. However, but she represents certainly what we see from World War II on. And she's very much, she's a police detective. And it's done she has a team with her working on homicides primarily, and so there's a team of detectives, but she too is a character that is sort of outside the mainstream society. All the other detectives in the team, they can socialize with each other, and they do, and she's quite separate from that, and she's always looking at them, watching them, wanting to fit in, but then doesn't allow herself to. She's a middle-aged character. She's very strong, but again, lacking some social skills. a lot of what she does is trying to organize, control the team, takes the control when she needs to. But it's a fascinating, fascinating series, I think. This is a particular one. This is one, Silent Voices. But I should say before I get into that, Anne Cleves also has a series with set in the Shetland Islands with Detective Jimmy Perez. And she has a new series that I'm going to plug this for. She's such a great author. But she has a new series with Detective named Matthew Venn, which is going to come out this next month. And it's... It's Wildfire is the name of the first novel that's coming out. So I know nothing about it other than it's coming. And but it should be fascinating if it's as good as the Shetland series and the Vera series. She's a great writer, but like with Silent Voices, a Vera novel opens with Vera at a health club, and she's middle aged, and she's maybe a little overweight, and she's in the water, and Vera swam slowly. An elderly man with a bathing hat pulled like a fully stretched going over, and then he wasn't a strong swimmer, but he was faster than she was. She was the sloth of the swimming world, but still. She was almost faint with the effort of moving, with pulling the bulk of her body through the water. But she becomes, as she goes through, she finds a case. She ends up going into a sauna, and there's somebody there. And it's after a while, and she's looking at the woman. Oh, she's very thin. She's young. And after a while, she realizes the person's dead. Because when the steam goes down, and then after she gets the team together, she's got to figure out how does she negotiate the fact that she was there, because she's doing this, and nobody knows she's there. It was, but anyway, she ends up with at the end of chapter two, once the case is there, great, she says, bloody great. But really, she was intrigued by the complications of the case. She was a good detective. She didn't often get the chance to prove it. And one of the problems here is that the in the sauna, there's no fingerprints, and so the forensic scene is.
that's clever. Yeah.
Well, that happens a lot. And when certain detectives, they get pressed into when they don't have the forensic evidence that they ought to. That happens a lot with Perrault. I mean, he's on the Murder on the Orient Express. It's stuck in the snow. There's no communication. They can't get a background check on anyone. Appointment with death. He doesn't have the scene at all. But one of the things that he does in which I think Vera does as well, is you let people talk. And lying is easy once or twice, but then after that it gets more complicated. And Perrault says, for let me tell you, my friends, to investigate a crime, it is only necessary to let the guilty party or parties talk. Always, in the end, they will tell you what you want to know. He paused. And I think the really fine detectives in the literary genre, whether it's Vera or Perrault or whoever, are the pauses in the stories. When they're talking to a suspect, potential suspect, or even a witness, and they ask a question and then there's silence. And then the person, and we think about that, if we're being questioned or something and suddenly, we get a question, can we answer it? And then there's no response from the detective. What is she or he thinking? So it's a very interesting idea. And then it does become difficult, I suppose.
And it becomes a good tactic and a good way also to add dialogue to a story, too, and kind of slow it down a little bit and let you climb into the detective's head and see how the detective is kind of deducing, and figuring out what's happening. Henry's on the phone from East Ham. Henry, thanks for giving us a call.
Oh, thank you for the program. I'm enjoying it very much.
Thank you.
I like to read a series about strong young women. Charles Todd is actually Charles Todd, a man and his mother here in the States, and they write about Bess Crawford, a nurse, World War I, a very courageous, great series. Another one, written by Susan Elliott McNeil, has a character named Maggie Hope, who becomes Churchill's secretary. She's an American. Finds herself in Britain and finds herself with a very mathematical mind and very smart. And I think that's a great one, too. That's a war story in England as well, Second World War. Flavia Deluce as a character by Alan Bradley. She's a kid who loves chemistry. It's a kind of a wacky series, but really good. And just one more, Rhys Bones, Welsh. It's a pen name, but she writes that her character is Evan Evans, and he's a police constable. And because there's a love interest with the local schoolmistress, that one should really be read in series, because you wonder what's going to happen there. So,
well, thank you
love
very
series,
much.
Obviously.
Yeah, well, that's great, and thank you for your suggestions. I see Jill frantically writing some of these down. And Bonnie from Chatham wrote in to remind us of the Chet and Bernie series by Spencer
Quinn.
Oh,
yes, absolutely. We wouldn't want to miss Peter Abraham's Chet and Bernie series, who is, I think, Spencer Quinn.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you for thank you for that, Henry, and also from Bonnie as well. What do you have up next, Jill? After you, unless you want to scribble, and we can go to Nellie. You ready?
Well, no, I want to make sure I get this one in because we have been talking about a lot of sort of classic mysteries, and this is a really fascinating series. The first in the series is called Blanche on the Lam. It's by Barbara Neely, and Barbara Neely was her character, Blanche White, is an African-American housekeeper with a knack for getting tangled up in murder mysteries. And she has, there have now been four in this series, but let me just read you a little bit of the beginning of Blanche on the Lam, because she is so funny. It begins, "Have you anything to say for yourself?" The judge gave Blanche a look that made her raise her handbag to her chest like a shield. "Your Honor, I'm sorry. Sorry? It most certainly is sorry. This is the fourth, I repeat, the fourth time you've been before this court on a bad check charge. Perhaps sometime in a jail cell will convince you to earn your money before you spend it like the rest of us. 30 days and restitution." "But Your Honor," Blanche's legs were suddenly weak. Her hands were freezing. Beads of sweat popped out on her nose. She wanted to tell the judge that a jail cell was cruel and unusual punishment for a person who panicked in slow elevators. She also wanted to ask him where the hell he got off lying about her like that. This was her second, not her fourth charge. Furthermore, just as she'd done the last time, she would have made good on the checks even if she hadn't been summoned to court. Hadn't she already covered 3 of the 5 checks she'd written? And right here in her handbag, she had the $42.50 she still owed, plus $50 for the fine, same as the judge had made her pay last time. But last time, she'd had a judge with his mind already on the golf course. He'd hardly bothered to look at her. There'd been no talk of jail that time. Anyway, this is Blanche. She seems like she's quite a character. She's a street-smart black domestic, as they say, on the run from the sheriff for passing a bad check. She winds up cooking and caring for edgy Ms. Grace, her husband Everett, her wealthy, reclusive Aunt Emmeline, and her somewhat retarded, which is what the reviewer says, cousin Mumsfield, at their summer home in Hokiesville, North Carolina. A quirky mystery debut that pits Blanche against a Falkernarian cast of oddballs that are all trying to kill each other. So I think she's a really interesting character in that, in fact, there are, and in, after that, you'll find more and more characters such as Blanche, but she was the first. Blanche on the Lam by Barbara Neely.
All right. An unusual one, which is fun to see to evidence, as you've kind of brought us through history a little bit, Nelson, to see where the genre is going. And, you know, it's really, of course, there are endless opportunities.
Well, and they actually credit her for being the person that blazed the trail for other women and minority crime novelists. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is. Nelson, we have time for maybe one more book. What are you going to pick?
I suppose since we've mentioned Agatha Christie, we'd be amiss if we didn't mention Miss Marple.
Yes.
And her constant knitting, which is, you know, it's always a question of what is she knitting? You know, because it never seems to be finished with it.
It's a mystery in and of itself.
It is. But she's,
we only have like half a minute left.
Right.
So.
So she's, but she's an interesting character. That she's somebody maybe like Father Brown, who observes people. She seems to be outside of mainstream life and seems a lot of things had passed her by, perhaps, but she's can look at things much clearer than the police, and often the police detectives, in the way that the trope works is that they come to her, which we see a lot in the private detectives, and whether first the police will dislike them, distrust them, find them an annoyance, and then turn to them.
But the readers seem to love them often from page one. We are out of time. I want to thank my guests, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at the Falmouth Public Library, and Nelson Richel, author and humanities professor at the Mass Maritime Academy. Thank you for those of you who called and wrote in with your suggestions. We will have a link to the books that we talked about a little later today on our website. That's capeandislands.org. I'm Catherine Iden, filling in for Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.